A History of Ancient Sparta, Lecture 8, The Ionian Revolt to Marathon.
By 491, Cleomenes had had more than enough of the machinations of his Euripontid co-king Demaratus, who had thwarted him at every turn for 15 years and whom he suspected of pro-Persian sympathies, as well as holding against him, no doubt, their long-standing personal rivalry. And what Cleomenes finally did was went to Delphi and bribed the Delphic oracle so that the oracle would claim that as Demaratus' father had believed long before, Demaratus was in fact illegitimate and a bastard. This succeeded in persuading the folks at Sparta. Demaratus was in fact deposed, and according to Herodotus, went finally to his mother, who was still alive, and said, "Who really is my father?" His mother told him that it was either Ariston, the Spartan king, or a god who had come to her during that period at night. But for all practical purposes, so far as she could tell, he was either legitimate or semi-divine. Nevertheless, he was deposed, and Cleomenes engineered that one of his cousins, Leotychidas, would take the kingship in his place. Leotychidas had special reason for hating his cousin Demaratus. Demaratus had earlier on, just when Leotychidas was about to get married, stolen his fiancée and married her himself. He was grateful to Cleomenes, some say a tool of Cleomenes, certainly glad to be king in Demaratus' place, and he taunted Demaratus publicly, asking him how he liked things now that he was no longer a king, in such a way that in powerfully shame-based Sparta, Demaratus just left, and ultimately, this I am sure, proved absolutely no surprise to Cleomenes, finally went to Persia, where he became part of Xerxes' entourage, and indeed, in later years, was an advisor, according to Herodotus, of Xerxes when Xerxes himself finally invaded Greece. Cleomenes, however, had himself finally gotten into trouble with the Spartans on two counts. The episode of burning the Argives in the sacred grove, whether or not it was Helots who had done the actual burning, did not go down well in pious Sparta, militarily decisive though it was. And when word came out that he'd bribed the Delphic oracle, that struck the Spartans as positively sacrilegious, and Cleomenes himself took off for the hinterlands for a while. Some folks think that he may have been contemplating fomenting a revolt against Sparta to get his power back. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm kind of inclined to doubt it. At any rate, he was recalled finally to Sparta and did come back, which suggests that if he had been plotting, he certainly didn't think the Spartans knew about it. But he had always been, so we are told, a bit of an odd lad. Many contemporary historical authorities think that Herodotus is a bit biased against him, and when Herodotus says that he'd been a little crazy his whole life and toward the end of his reign got flat out super crazy, some folks are inclined to doubt that. In any case, what Herodotus says is that after he came back to Sparta, he took to menacing people with his staff on street corners, just walking up to people and waving this stick in their face and generally making a nuisance of himself to the point that the Spartans decided what they needed to do was restrain him. So they put him in the stocks. And so the story goes, while he was in the stocks, really crazy now, he persuaded the helot who was guarding him to give him a knife, which, as a former king of Sparta, talking to a helot, the power differential, even if you were crazy and in the stocks, I think probably would have been plenty enough to persuade a helot to give him the knife. And what Cleomenes thereupon did was began slicing pieces of flesh off his legs, moving up his legs to his thighs, moving up his thighs to his midriff, and in effect, slowly committing suicide. What the Spartans themselves said was not so much that he was crazy in a neurological sense by birth or as a result of stress or whatever, but rather that he had at some point picked up the very un-Greek habit of drinking unmixed wine and lots of it, and he finally collapsed through what we would term terminal alcoholism. Whatever the story finally is, he was gone and in no very pleasing way. Others have thought, and this I have no strong opinion on myself one way or the other. I find myself actually, I suppose, inclined to believe the traditional account that he really did kill himself. But some have thought, Sparta being the secretive place that it was, that they just decided, the Spartan leadership group, that he was getting to be more trouble than he was worth and just had him killed. Whatever happened, by 490 he was dead, 490 or 491, and in his place, his half-brother Leonidas ascended the throne, having married Cleomenes, or ultimately marrying, in any case, Cleomenes' daughter, Gorgo. Leonidas, we will hear a great deal of shortly. One thing that sets Leonidas apart, and there are many, but one thing that sets him apart in any case from most Spartan kings is that the heir apparent to either royal house in Sparta did not have to go through the agoge and did not go through the agoge, the traditional upbringing that all other Spartan citizens were subjected to, or enjoyed, or were shaped by, or all of the above. Leonidas did. And it's interesting and perhaps not surprising that among the most effective Spartan kings were those who were not exempted from the traditional upbringing, but participate in it as indeed members of the royal family, but not heirs apparent. Leonidas had gone through the 100% full treatment. Well, in 492, remember, Mardonius, whose ambition was, if the Persians ever succeeded in conquering Greece, to become satrap or local ruler, in effect governor, viceroy of the new province or satrapy of Greece, should there come to be one, he had led a punitive expedition toward Athens around the Aegean to the north, which had come to grief in storms off Mount Athos in the far northern Aegean. This time, Dares mounted a punitive addition more or less right across the Aegean, which was explicitly designed, perhaps, I suspect, as a first step toward more wide-ranging conquests in the area, but certainly to punish Eritrea on the island of Euboea and Athens for their presumptions. The leaders were Artaphernes and Datis, not Mardonius this time, whose bad success last time perhaps had led to his being put on the shelf for at least a while. And this led ultimately, of course, to the very famous Battle of Marathon, which was perhaps Athens' finest hour, so they thought. Many people would argue Salamis, about which more a bit later. But for the Athenians themselves, Marathon reigned in subsequent era crystal clear as their moment of self-definition. The Persian fleet got across this time without any problems from storms to speak of, landed at Eretria and took care of Eretria and subjected it without any inordinate trouble, and thereafter, at the suggestion of the long-deposed former tyrant of Athens, Hippias, who had always been, at least to some degree, pro-Persian, or so his enemies thought, and after he had been deposed, had gone to Persia, he, now an old man, was in hopes that Persia would reinstall him as ruler of Athens, now under Persian hegemony. He was the one who picked Marathon as an appropriate landing place for the Persian expeditionary force. Well, by now, the Spartans and the Athenians were clearly in it more or less together, and they were both expecting a Persian response. So when the Athenians got firm news that the Persians were not just planning mischief, but doing everything in their power to bring it about, they dispatched a man by the name of Philippides, or Pheidippides, accounts vary, to let the Spartans know that the Persians were a clear and present danger, and that Athens was going to need Spartan help as soon as possible. The story has often been told, but it's a splendid story. Pheidippides, or Philippides, was what the Greeks called a hemerodromos, a wonderful word which means all-day runner, a professional courier who presumably had trained for life to be enabled to run very long distances at the fastest possible speed. I presume just the ruggedness of the Greek countryside being such, and the rareness of horses being such, that the fastest way to communicate emergency information was with a long-distance runner. And it was a long-distance run. The distance between Athens and Sparta is about 150 miles, which is a sextuple marathon or quintuple marathon, more or less. Not only that, in the Greek summer, temperatures, as we've mentioned before, in southern Greece, range certainly in the 30s Celsius, in the 80s or 90s Fahrenheit, and Greece is a very mountainous country. So this is a pretty formidable run beyond a super marathon. Philippides made it to Sparta, though, in about 36 hours, which is not bad, where he told the Spartans that the Athenians needed their help, and needed their help pretty much now. Meanwhile, something very interesting happened to him, and this is, to me, one of the oddest things in Herodotus. I hardly know how to take this, presented deadpan as it is. Herodotus writes, "Now, Philippides himself reported to the Athenians afterward that when he was running in the vicinity of Mount Parthenion overlooking Tegea, getting towards Sparta, you know, about 80, 90 miles into the run, the god Pan fell in with him." What? Here is this guy running along, and suddenly the god Pan appears and shouted out his name, Philippides. And he ordered him to ask why the Athenians were paying no attention to him, the god Pan, though he was well disposed toward them, had already and often been of service to them, and would serve them further in the future, not least at the upcoming Battle of Marathon. We're told that the Athenians believed this report was true, and once their affairs were settled and stable again, set up a shrine to Pan below the Acropolis in response to his message, and indeed they propitiate Pan with sacrifices and a torch race every year. Just so you know, sometimes there are unexpected benefits, I suppose, to extremely long distance running under duress. Well, the Spartans were more than willing to help the Athenians, and when the time came, dispatched 2,000 of their elite crack citizen hoplites at a very fast march. They did not make it in 36 hours to Marathon, but they made it in not too much more than that, and in armor, but in the event didn't get there in time. Rather like their efforts, perhaps, to aid Croesus several generations before. And the reason they couldn't get there on time was because of their piety. Some have argued that, in fact, there was hell at unrest at the time, this being shortly after the death of Cleomenes. That may or may not be true. I'm more inclined to take it at face value. When the Carnea was going on, major festival that it was to the Spartans, they were most reluctant to leave. They didn't want to be impious. They didn't want to offend the gods. The Spartan idea was, how could you expect to win a battle if the gods were fighting against you? And certainly, once the requisite time period had passed and the moon was in its correct phase, as far as the Spartans were concerned, they came with better than all deliberate speed and were duly impressed at the battlefield. They marched on past Athens to the battlefield itself and congratulated the Athenians heartily on what, from a Spartan perspective, I would imagine, was unexpectedly good work. Well, the Persians landed at Marathon, called the Plain of Marathon, traditionally, and it is a plain of sorts, though Greece being the mountainous region that it is, a plain in Greece does not look a great deal like the Dakotas or Kansas. It's a small, enclosed, basically estuarian river valley, but it was or would have been suitable for cavalry, the Persians' strongest military arm being cavalry, in particular, mounted archers, which don't work so well in forests, and likewise don't work so well in really rough mountainous country. So there are a lot of reasons that Marathon was a likely place for the Persians to disembark. It's not clear exactly how big their forces were. The tendency of modern military historians in assessing ancient accounts of battles, accounts of ancient battles, if you will, is ordinarily radically to downgrade the ancient figures for how many troops were involved. That frame of mind at work, people are inclined these days to say that the Persian forces probably numbered 20-odd thousand or thereabouts, maybe as many as 40, hard to tell for sure. In any case, they clearly outnumbered the forces of the Athenians, which were less than 10,000, with about 1,000 troops as a surprise help from their nearby ally in Boeotia, the little city or polis of Plataea. That would have made the Athenian forces outnumbered something on the order of 2-to-1 or more, maybe 4-to-1, maybe 3-to-1, maybe even more than that. Hard to say for sure, but no doubt about it, the Athenians were significantly outnumbered about 25 miles away from Athens itself at Marathon. And there they waited for a while. And the wait has exercised the ingenuity of scholars. My own suspicion is, and there's some ancient evidence for this, that the Persians were waiting for a pro-Persian, pro-Hippias faction in Athens to rise in support of Hippias and the Persians, and hence, in some sense, to make a battle certainly easier, if not, in fact, simply unnecessary. And there's talk of, on the mountains between Marathon and Athens, bronze shields being used as signals to suggest when and if the hoped-for uprising took place. In the event, it didn't. But there's another mystery of sorts about Marathon, and that is the Persians' strongest military arm was their cavalry. And shortly before the actual Battle of Marathon, their cavalry set off in horse transports to round Cape Sunion, the southernmost cape of Attica, to sail to Athens itself. Whether there was some kind of mix-up, whether plans went astray, whatever the problem was, when push came to shove, quite literally, the Persians found themselves at Marathon without their cavalry, who were literally at sea at the time, and hence without their strongest arm, and hence unable to flank the Athenoplatean line, which would have been a relatively easy matter for cavalry to accomplish. In any case, soon after the ships departed, whether the Athenians realized that they'd departed or not, I suspect that they probably did, the Athenians formed up their own line of hoplites, fighting in phalanx form. The Persians outnumbered them, so to stretch themselves thin enough so that they could confront the Persian infantry line, which they were facing at equal distance without being flanked even by infantry on the sides, they had to thin their line in the center. The Athenoplatean line at Marathon reportedly was 8 deep on the flanks, which was the usual number, but only 2 deep in the center. They had to thin out the lines to prevent themselves from being flanked. At this point, too, with the Battle of Lade and the quelling of the Ionian Revolt still in very recent and severe memory, indeed that's why the Persians were there, it was to be expected, and the Persians clearly did expect, that Athenian morale against Persian forces would be low. There had been no major victory anywhere, any time so far, of Hellenic or Greek forces against Persian forces, and indeed, in the days beforehand, Eretria had already fallen. Thus, the Persians were very surprised when, after getting as close as they could to the Persians. I would suspect probably within archery range. The Athenians and Plataeans broke into a trot and charged them, if not at a run. I'm not sure how running in full armor for an extended distance works, though in fact there was an Olympic contest in precisely that event in the ancient Olympics. But nevertheless, they crashed into the Persian lines at a run, which that in itself is a sign of high morale and eagerness. Evidently short-stepped the Persians just a bit. What happened once the Othismos, the battle line, was joined was the Persian center, which was thicker than the Greek center, the Athenian center, began to push and indeed even slightly began to break through the only two hoplite line at that point. But meanwhile, the Greek wings bested their Persian opponents and closed in on the Persian center. And the Athenians won, and won big. One reason for their victory was the disproportion in armament between the two forces. The Athenian soldiers and Plataean soldiers here were hoplites, heavily armored with shield, helmet, and so forth. The Persians, by contrast, fought with wicker shields, which were designed primarily to deflect or slow down arrows, and fought as well not in armor, but in something like a stuffed winter coat, padded with fiber, which again was designed to slow down the impact of arrows and to dull the impact of edged weapons, but was nowhere near as effective as bronze. As a result, the Persian troops were certainly more mobile, but when it came to close-in, hand-to-hand fighting, they found themselves at a very considerable disadvantage, especially if they were unsupported by their cavalry, as in this instance they were. Well, the Marathonomachoi, the men of Marathon, the men who fought at Marathon, were considered and considered themselves the best and noblest of the Athenians ever after, and were told that the casualties for the Battle of Marathon came out as follows. As usual, the victorious side, the side that did not flee, suffering many, many fewer. The Athenians purportedly lost precisely 192 dead. And indeed, in the Parthenon frieze, there is a section which contains precisely 192 figures, which many people have thought was a memorial of sorts to the men who were killed at Marathon. The Persians, according to Herodotus, by contrast, lost about 6,400. So it was a major, virtually a crushing defeat for Persia and a major victory for Athens. Lots of the casualties came as the Persians were fleeing to their ships and attempting to disembark. And it's there that the brother of Aeschylus, the playwright, lost his life. He was attempting to hold back a Persian ship, which was attempting to flee, and got his hand cut off and bled to death. Aeschylus himself participated in the battle, and interestingly, when many years later he came to die, he did not mention his work as a tragedian on his grave, but said instead that the long-haired Mede, the long-haired Persian, could testify to his courage, too, as a veteran certainly of Marathon and very probably of Salamis as well. Well, the Athenians knew perfectly well that they had not defeated the whole Persian force, that part of the Persian force was already on the way to Athens, and the rest of them had disembarked. So immediately after the battle, they marched the 25 miles back to Athens, hoping to beat the Persian fleet, which they succeeded in doing. And indeed, shortly after they arrived, the Persian fleet turned up in the harbor, saw the same guys they'd fought earlier on, thought better of the matter, and went home. End, so to speak, of round one. Well, as you might imagine, Darius, with vastly, overwhelmingly, all but unimaginably greater resources at his disposal than any conceivable Greek coalition, was unwilling to take the result of the Battle of Marathon as the final word on Greco-Persian relations, and immediately set about planning to take care of his Hellenic problem once and for all by either intimidating the whole region into submitting, or, in the case of certainly Sparta and Athens, conquering and destroying them. He, however, died before he was able to accomplish his aims. He was succeeded by his son Xerxes, who was very eager to match, or if possible, to exceed the accomplishments of his predecessors, Cyrus, Cambyses, and Darius, particularly Cyrus and Darius. And he continued preparations for a much bigger full-scale invasion of Greece at which he himself would be present. His plans were deflected, though, by, among other things, a revolt in Egypt, which had to be put down. But that accomplished in 484, he began to make preparations in earnest, sending emissaries to ask for earth and water from all the Greek poleis available, except for Athens and Sparta, who for obvious reasons were deliberately excluded. They had not treated his previous emissaries or the previous Persian emissaries very well. And he began building supply dumps along his provisional invasion route into Greece. Astonishingly, for a while this was disbelieved, but archaeological evidence has in fact confirmed it. He also set his subjects to work making a canal across the landward end of the Athos Peninsula so that his ships would not fall into the trouble that Mardonius' failed invasion attempt had fallen into roughly a decade before, and they dug all the way through the remains of that canal still survive. It was evidently wide enough that ships could go through either direction simultaneously. He also made plans to bridge the Hellespont with bridges roughly a mile wide, pontoon bridges, and set out orders for the requisite ropes, huge, thick ropes to secure this pontoon bridge to be made, and began gathering his forces. In common with most people, most places, most times, lots of Greeks did not take the threat, the gathering storm, with full seriousness while it was far off. But by the late 480s, the signs were clear that trouble of an unprecedented magnitude was on its way.
This ends Lecture 8.